ॐ भरताय प्रतिभूतिकां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम् वीतरागभयक्रोधाः मन्मया मामुपाश्रिताः बहवो ज्ञानतपसा भूता मद्भावमागताः वीत राग भय क्रोधाः मन मयाः माम उपाश्रिताः बहवः ज्ञान तपसा भूताः मद भावम आगताः. In the previous verse, now Krishna is kind of reconnecting with the vision, and was talking about starting to talk about the Jivan Mukta. And this verse also, he's talking about the Jivan Mukta when he's really gained this knowledge. In the previous verse, he said after talking about being what it meant to be an avatar, so he spent several verses on that, talking about being an avatar and this being his whole creation. Then he says, kind of bringing it back to several verses before, where he had described himself as being free from time and free from birth, and to be the Lord of all beings. So, which is what he had established in chapters 2 and 3. So that whole vision now he brought back, and he said, having just now talked about being an avatar, he said, those who know me in truth, those who know me as I really am and who understand Janma Karma Chame Divyam, the Janma, this birth as an avatar, and also all of these karmas that I've done that are Divya, means they're coming from Ishwara, the Divine. So those who understand those in reality, the truth of all of this that I'm telling you, then he says, those people, then having given up this physical body, once the prarabdha is through, that caused you to take this birth and will take you, your karmas will take you all the way through, then when this birth is over, then those people you won't take, that having realized this, those people won't take another birth. And those people then just resolve into me. They come to me. So now what does it mean? They don't take a birth. They don't take another birth, and they attain me. They come to me. And so what does that mean for them to come to me? So he's giving a little bit more now. He says, talking more about the person who has knowledge. So here he says, one compound, Vita Raga Bhaya Krodaha. Those who are, nominative plural, Vita means free from. Krodha is anger, going backwards. Bhaya, fear. Raga, desire. So Raga means Raga Dvesha, all of my likes and dislikes. Having those Raga and Dvesha, those Ragas and Dveshas, those things themselves, they cause bhaya. Because as soon as I want something, means I need this in order to be happy, then there's going to be fear because I won't necessarily get it. Right? I need it. Desire means if I've got a raga, I need this in order to be happy. If I need it to be happy, there's too many obstructions that could come in my way. Stop me from getting it, or once I get it, take it away from me. So the very having the raga, once I have the raga, the bhaya comes. Once I have the passion, then the bhaya automatically comes. And the krodha will come too. Krodha means the anger. Anger comes whenever there's an obstruction to the fulfillment of the desire. And so these three, they're like a trinity. You don't have one without the other. Maybe for a moment, but not really. Because there's, you even have imaginal anger. Say you have raga. You have a raga for something. You have imaginal bhaya before anything's happened. Right? Because you know what could go wrong. You know that this desire could not fructify. Or that you know that it could be taken away from you. So that brings about fear, because I need it in order for me to be full, for me to be complete. It's not a little thing. These desires, let me think, I want a desire for a glass of water or something like that. That doesn't have to be a life-threatening desire. But throughout our life, we do have life-threatening desires, because I feel that if this doesn't work out for me, I won't be happy. If this doesn't happen for me, my life will be destroyed. So you have to think of desires like that. They're the big desires. And those big desires bring about big fears. Right? Fears of my own destruction. Destruction in terms of my well-being, my being able to have a happy and complete life. If this doesn't go the way I need it to go, I can't be free. I can't be happy. It's especially true in love relationships. Especially because that's where our commitments are, you know. That's where our real attachments are, toward people, toward things too, toward situations. We have them toward situations also, but nothing's as strong as love relationships. Family. Not just love. I don't mean just partners. I don't mean just that. It's family, you know. And so that's where I can really be hurt. Where if this doesn't work out, or if this is, if my child doesn't do well, or you know, if there's something, if my partner were to leave me, or if my partner dies, all of these type of things, I don't know what I would do. That's just an example. That's just one element. But that's where a lot of the big desires are located in terms of our personal relationships. In terms of our securities, you know, when I think about it, the instant I think about it, I realize that I could lose it. That's why bhaya is just circling around the raga dvesha. It just circles, it hovers there. And hovering around the bhaya is krodha. Because the bhaya, the fear, makes me angry. Because, like this, when I think of what can go wrong, then of course there's players involved that can cause it to go wrong. That can cause me to lead a life of pain. Because if I don't fulfill this desire, or if this doesn't go well for me, my life is ruined. I'll have a painful, excruciating life, and it's your fault. You know? And you are ruining my life. You are destroying my life. And that creates, if you have that feeling towards someone, it's usually toward a person or people, situation, you know, it creates so much pain inside. Because that bhaya and krodha are circling around. They're circling around inside of you, generating bhaya and krodha, which are emotions. Right? All three are emotions. Right? If you have a desire, that's an emotion also. There's feeling involved. With bhaya and krodha, there's feeling involved. It's all pain. And so this pain, when I'm enmeshed in this pain that builds upon itself, right? Because once the fear starts and the krodha starts, then it's hard, as long as the desire is there, it's hard to release myself from it, right? Especially as an ajnani. But this says vita, so understand what they mean. They're not talking about having a cookie. They're talking about in your life, the things that really matter to you, the things that you actually feel, this is not going well, it's destroying my life. This is not happening for me, I'll be finished. And we all have that, you know, as the prarabdha unfolds, there are all of these big ones. This says, vita raga bhaya krodha, the one who is free from all of that. To be free from all of that, it requires, as we'll see, it requires jnanam, it requires knowledge, it requires self-knowledge, because you have to know what the source of the ananda is that you're really seeking. That allows you to be released from the raga. If you're released from the raga, you're released. Once the raga becomes mithya, the bhaya, the fear, and the krodha become mithya too. They become controllable. The bhaya, the fear and the anger are controllable. Once the raga, once the passion, the desire becomes mithya, means it loses its reality. It loses its reality only when I recognize what is the source of the ananda I'm seeking. Because this ananda, this well-being, is superimposed on that object or on that situation. I have to bring it back to myself. Unless I can bring the source of the wholeness, which is my own swarupa, which is my own nature, ananda, unless I can re-own it, de-affect it from the object, de-affect it from the person, de-affect it from the situation, I am held by that situation. Because really, that situation, honestly, that situation has become myself. Myself has entered into the object, and it's away from me, and I have to have it back. What do I mean? The ananda, the wholeness that you seek, has become projected on the object. Therefore, you have to get that object. You must have it, or your life is destroyed. This is mithya. It isn't true. It simply is not true. But you have this relationship toward one object. You might, you know, you should usually one at a time for these people. You have it, right? But it's not true. It's an illusion. Because when you bring back yourself, because of your knowledge, you bring back yourself, you give yourself back to yourself, then this object is still there, the person is still there, the situation is still there. You appreciate them, you love them, you allow them to be as they are, you allow the situation to be as it is. You still have all of the same love and care. You still have the raga, but the raga is what we call a dugdha bija. It's a burnt seed. It's lost its power, you know, because you've brought yourself back. And so that type of, when the person who has knowledge, remember the Bhagavad Gita is written for the mumukshu. It's a seeker. Well, chapter 2 and 3 has already been unfolding this vision, right? And has unfolded over and over again that the nature of the ananda that I seek that gets superimposed on the object and then I go after it, that is my being. And so my mind starts to appreciate it and appreciate this as Ishvara, as we'll see. Then more and more my mind can pull itself back. In another way of saying it, my knowledge, what I know to be true, can pull my mind back from this trouble it's gotten itself into, from this pain that it's gotten itself into. It can pull it back into, with my knowledge can pull my mind back into myself. And then you'll see, for a moment, this is kind of how it works for the big ones. For a moment, your mind relaxes and can breathe again. And all is well. You have a moment of peace. Because you've brought your mind back. You've de-affected it from this object. And you relax and you relish that moment of peace and that relaxation and that freedom from the stranglehold of that raga. But then you find that your mind will do it again. Because it's a big raga. It's not a little one. It'll do it again, and it'll do it again, and it'll do it again. But you get used to pulling it back. And eventually, for the big ones, you know, that have a hold on you, there comes a time that you're able to let that situation be as it is. And then you revel. You have your main ananda is in the fact that you can be in that situation and still and be free. You can be free in that situation. You can be free with that person. You can love that person and be free with that person. You can be around people who are totally inimical to you. Inimical to you because they're stopping you from being able to have life the way you would like it to be. Those are inimical people. Such people are there, and they should be. This isn't Svarga Loka. You know, this loka is 50-50. So that means you get 50, 50% of the situations are really conducive to your being like a jnani, enjoying, you know. Mind is at peace, but your mind is at peace because the situation is conducive to your mind being at peace. Things are, for the moment, as you would like them to be. People are, for the moment, as you would like them to be. Nothing is rankling you. 50%, you get. Other 50%, Bhagavan has to figure out ways, you know, to create situations that are meant to test you. They're meant to make you a mumukshu. They're created to force your maturity. That's a nice way of looking at it. They're given to cause you pain if you're a samsari. For a mumukshu, though, that's not really you can look at it that way, but really a mumukshu should look at it, okay, this situation, you know, which is meant to cause me pain, that's what it's designed to do, becomes my sadhana. Because then the question is, why is it causing me pain? Why? What is it that I'm asking of this situation? You know, what is it that I want? How much, what do I have at stake here? Because definitely, what you'll be able to see it in the desire template, I really need this to be happy. That's the belief that's caught you. I really need this to be happy. It's come and grabbed you, strangling you, and causing a great deal of pain. You know, and that to that you have to bring your knowledge to that over and over and over again, so that you can release Ishwar. It's like letting Ishwar be Ishwar and letting this body, mind, sense organs belong to the Prarabdha. Right? This body, mind, sense organs, really, in truth, it is Ishwara. And in what form is it? Do we appreciate it as Ishwara? We appreciate it as this body, mind, sense organs took this birth at this particular time based upon my prior karmas. The sanchitta is now in the Prarabdha. So this is Prarabdha karma. You've got your whole life. It's going to unfold 50-50 on this loka. Okay? It is Ishwara. Okay, so now, am I going to participate in Ishwara's creation, of which this body, mind, sense organs are a part? In which case, if I allow this to be Ishwara, you know, and my mind is resting in myself, then this Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha is there. Because I'm allowing this creation to be Ishwara, and this body, mind, sense organs is part of it. And I watch it unfold and I appreciate it. When it's causing me pain, that becomes a sadhana, right? Because when it's causing me pain, then I, the jiva, has now sprung into being, right? Now I need something to be different so that I can be happy. I need you to be in a certain way so that I can be happy. Or, you know, I need my mind to be in a certain way so that I can be happy. That's also a really interesting one. You know, I need my mind to be in a certain way so that I can be happy. And since you're not acting like you're supposed to, but then you see the jiva has come. Even in reference to your own thoughts, your own mind, the jiva has come who says, if you're going to be like this, I can't be happy. See what I mean? Whether it's internal or out, or external, that jiva comes, when the jiva comes by that limited one, you know, who is no longer Ishwara, is no longer the whole, that limited one has come, which is fine. Why shouldn't it come? It's only been limitless, beginningless lifetimes that this, our psyche has behaved in this way because of self-ignorance. And so once you get knowledge, you know, and you start seeing, it's not like this network of connections just goes away. You know, it takes time. It takes time for this knowledge to really assimilate, you know, so that the mind is just used to seeing the world in that way and staying home. You know, otherwise it goes out. Just its forgetfulness, its habitual behavior. You pull it back up, you keep going back. There comes a time when your mind is so used to staying home that it doesn't get pulled out in the same degree as it gets pulled out, it gets pulled back in. And as it's being pulled out, it's pulled in. It's getting pulled out, but as it goes, it's nicely brought back in. And no harm done, you know, which is a lot different than when we find ourselves lost. You know, and then we have to go and, you know, pull it back in. It just takes longer. See what I mean? So here, what Krishna is talking about here is for the one, you know, whose mind is pulled back in. So what he says is, Vita, the one who now is free from this raga, vaya, and krodha, right? This passion, likes, raga, dvesha, likes and dislikes, and the fear and the anger, you know, that all of that causes. That person is manmayaha, is nothing but me. Manmaya means like anamaya kosha, the kosha that's anamaya, made of food. This is manmaya. Manmayaha, nominative plural. That person is nothing but me. Nothing but me. That's such a beautiful statement. That those people, we'll see, in the next verse it says who are jnanis, who have gained this knowledge. They are nothing but me. Okay? As yourself, as Atma, you are Brahman. Right? Nothing but me. Right? As the Jiva, body, mind, sense organs, nothing but me. Ishwara. This Maya Upadhi, right? This whole Maya Upadhi, which is just manifest knowledge, which is only Ishwara. What is this body? Is it part and parcel of the limitless manifestation of Ishwara, or is it separate? Is it Ishwara or not? That's the question. Is this body Ishwara or not? If it's not Ishwara, then what is it? Well, it's me. Who is that me? That's the jiva. Then you are the conscious being in an unconscious world, right? You say, this is me, this is me, and this is the world. And that's your choice, right? Either I am this, and this is the world, like an inert world, and I'm an individual in an inert world, or this is Ishwara. It's a sentient being, right? Manifest knowledge. And this is part and parcel of that. So the jnani sees is manmayaha. For that one, everything is me alone. They're only me. There is nothing else but me. As Ishwara or as my own being. And this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishwara. When that's the case, it's such an interesting situation. Because when you recognize that, here you are as a jiva. It means you've got sense organs, you've got a mind, you've got a body, all of which are part and parcel, warp and woof, Ishwara. And you get to look around and walk around and talk, knowing all the while that this actor here is an actor in a much bigger play. This is part of a much bigger play. This, all of it, every bit of it, is included in a much bigger play, which is Ishwara, a much bigger story. And this, all of it, every single bit of it, is part of that story. And so now, not only are you part of the story, you have jnanam, you know you're part of the story. And then you revel in being part of that story. You are interested in the story. But the attachment isn't there, because if I am the whole, and I recognize my being as the very source of the ananda that I had been superimposing continually on the world, I don't ask Ishwara to make me happy. I am Ishwara, right? And the ananda that I seek is my own being. And so the struggle is over. So any mitya struggle that comes out of my antakarana, comes out of my mind, just from beginningless habituation to being a jiva in the world, I understand that. And that's fine, I just bring it back, because my ananda isn't being upset by the mithya. Because I see the mithya as mithya. So I see the mithya raga, I see the mithya baya, I see the mithya krodha, and I pull back, you know, all of the mithya, and just let it sit, and let it be. Because my mind has a home base, ananda. So he said, what he says, so that's the manmayaha. He says, everything, all of this is me alone. For the one for whom this baya, this raga baya krodha is vita, is gone. There's only me here. And then he says, mam upashvitaha. And those people for whom this is the case, those people, they just, they resort, upashvitaha means they resort to me. With that, mam is me. Upashritaha means they resort to me. They resolve themselves in me. So instead of resolving themselves out here, but going out here for refuge, oh, I have to be here. I need this to be happy. I need to have these things to make my life complete. They don't resolve out here. They resolve in Ishwara itself. They resolve in myself as Brahman. And they resolve. So see this. There's a resolution in the truth of this mithya creation, which is Brahman, which is my own being. So the resolution is in my own being. So they resolve in me as Brahman, and they resolve in the creation as Ishwara. Right? The body, mind, sense organs, the upadis, resolve into the Maya upadi. What I'm thinking of. These are the terms. I don't use these terms that much. Vyeshti upadi, Sameshti upadi. Have they heard these? Sameshti upadi? The Sameshti upadi is the Maya upadi. It's Ishwara. Sameshti means whole, the complete. The upadi, which is Sameshti, the total upadi. The total upadi is Ishwara. It's also called Maya upadi. Ishwara's body. Ishwara is the Maya upadi. Right? Where the whole infinite creation is an upadi. In the sense, it's a manifest knowledge. It's Ishwara's body. Ishwara's body-mind, we can say. Ishwara's infinite mind. It's called Maya upadi. Okay? The jiva upadi is this jiva, body, mind, sense organs, that from its standpoint, it has alpajñaha. It has limited knowledge. Right? Because my knowledge has to do with my limited mind and my sense organs. So this has limited knowledge. I'm a jiva walking through the creation. So this is called vyeshti upadi, the limited upadi. It's a part to the whole. So this vyeshti upadi, the jiva, is part and parcel of the maya upadi, the sameshti upadi. Right? And so where is the resolution? What does the one who has have knowledge? What is the resolution? Where do they resort? What do they resort to? Well, on the one level, I resort to myself, to the Atma, to Brahman, to myself, which is the Satchit Ananda, which is the very wholeness that I've ever sought in the world. All that I've ever sought in the world is myself. Is the Ananda, which is me. So the mind resolves into the Ananda, which is me, not an Ananda that has been superimposed on the world. So there's that resolution, and then this body, mind, sense organs. Where does it resolve? It doesn't resolve into Brahman, since I am Brahman. It resolves into Ishwara. So this body, mind, sense organs, the jiva, is recognized as part and parcel of Ishwara and being taken care of by the whole. And I can allow that when I don't need Ishwara to be in a particular way. Right? If I need Ishwara to make me happy, in other words, and I'm calling the shots, Ishwara, in order for me to be happy, I need you to do this. And I need you to do this. And I need you to do that. Are you going to do it? I don't know.
Better.
I hope so. And I give all kinds of prayers and beseech you to make the universe like this so that I can be happy. And we have a prayerful life. We pray for these type of things. That's why I'm not criticizing. We do that. And each of our hearers and says yes or no. Right? But this is different. This is where I recognize that for, as a jnani, I'm not praying to Ishvara in that sense. If I do pray to Ishvara, it's a mithya prayer. Right? Please, Ishvara, do this. I'm not saying that we don't do that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that either. But I'm saying there's another level of the reality that is holding you. And that is, all of this is Ishvara, which includes my body and my mind and my sense organs and any kartritvam or boktritvam, the whole thing is Ishvara. And so the jiva resolves into Ishvara and the atma resolves into Brahman. There's no resolution there, there's resolution of knowledge. And my mind sits in the ananda, not an ananda that's been projected onto the world, but the ananda which is my very swarupa. And so that mind is free. It's free of this vita, you know, raga bhayakrodha. Manmayaha, there's nothing here but me. And that being so, my mind resorts to myself as Ishvara, as the Atma, as Brahman. Okay, that's the third one. Then he says, so now, in Shankar's Bhashya, this was kind of, he mentions this as though Arjuna is saying, I haven't heard this talk about the Jivan Mukta or any of this. Where's this been? Where's all of this coming from now? And so Krishna says, you know, it kind of seemed probably the look on Arjuna's face that I haven't heard this. So he says, so Krishna says, Bahabaha, many, many people, Jnana Tapasa Putaha, who have been purified by the tapas, by the austerity, the tapas, the sadhana of knowledge. Jnana tapasa. Many people who have been purified by the tapas of knowledge. And what does he say? Madbhavam agataha. They have come to madbhava, my nature. Mad means me. Bhava means my being. They have attained my being. How have they attained your being? Because when we think of attain, it's like they've reached it. They've gone on a journey and they've finally reached me. It's not that. Because how have they? Purified by knowledge. Jnana tapasa. The means for that reaching is jnana. And what does knowledge do? Knowledge doesn't take you anywhere. Knowledge removes ignorance. What needs to be purified, see the jiva is the one who's bound by ajnanam, by ignorance. And that ignorance itself is the cause for the kamakrodha, right? In fact, we say this as a trinity. Avidya, kama, krodha. You can add baya in there too, but it's often said these three. Avidya, ignorance, causes kama, causes desire, causes krodha. Causes anger. Avidya, kama, krodha. So that's just something that's on the side, something that's often said. So, what do I need to be purified from? Avidya, kama, krodha. So what if I say, avidya, kama, bhaya, krodha. Avidya, raga, right? Bhaya, krodha. Same thing. So ignorance itself is the cause for the passion, cause for the raga dvesha, which is the cause for the baya, which is the cause for the krodha. The raga dvesha is the cause for this dyad, baya krodha. Both come up because of the raga dvesha. What causes the raga dvesha is avidya, is ajnana, ignorance. How is the ignorance removed? Jnana. So those who are purified means they're freed of this avidya, kama, krodha, the ignorance, the desire, the anger, the fear. Those who are purified means freed from that. How? Through the tapas of jnanam. Now it's interesting, they say the tapas of jnanam, because tapas means like an austerity, like a sadhana, like a practice, the practice of jnanam. So what does it mean? Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. You're given the knowledge, okay? But then your mind, say just in teaching, you're given this knowledge. But then your mind continues to act out because of the past samskaras. Right? The vairagya, because the vairagya isn't complete. And so now your mind is now being held. The mind, which has all of these samskaras, all of these tendencies, all of these old desires, all the lack of vairagya, all of these things, this mind has to be purified. Right? How? In the light of knowledge. So how is that done? By the tapas of knowledge, because your buddhi is the one that has knowledge. Okay? Now your mind that has all of these samskaras, you know what I mean by that? All of these tendencies, all of this baggage that we're, all of the complexes, all of the baggage, all of the likes and dislikes, all that we've brought with us from beginningless, right? All of the samskaras that we are carrying around with us, all of our likes and dislikes and needs and all of these things, all of these are there now, being held by my knowledge. And so now my knowledge is what is going to purify, is what really purifies this mind. Because as my mind brings up all of these old tendencies, it brings it up into the fire of my knowledge. That's why a fire is often used here. It brings it up into the fire of my knowledge, which burns it to ash. That's one of the examples. You know, all of the samskaras, all of these things, the avidya, all of my misconceptions, continue to rise in the light, in the fire of my knowledge. And then my knowledge, because part of what's included in this knowledge is how to handle it. With the karma yoga, right? That Bhagavan spends so much time teaching karma yoga. Why? So I know how to handle this mind that has the doership, the kartritvam and the bhoktritvam. So I know how to handle that when it comes up. So I know how to be with it. So I know how to be kind to my mind. So I know how to educate it. Just like you educate a child, you don't feel badly about that. You teach it how to be in the world. You teach a child how to be in the world. Now you have to teach your mind how to be in the world of the jnani. Right? You teach your mind how to be a jnani, because now you know, the buddhi knows, you have knowledge. You know yourself. But then this mind, all of these different parts of the mind, all of these different doubts, all of these things have to be purified. The avidya has to be purified. As the avidya is purified by knowledge, means it's eliminated, then all of the samskaras are, all of the tendencies then are purified by that knowledge. See what I mean? By bringing the mind back. The mind goes out, you bring it back. The mind gets itself into trouble, causing you a great deal of pain. How do you bring it? What do you do? Really, seriously, just think, because you do this, you just have to be conscious of it. Your mind has gone out, you're stuck in, you know, I have to have it to be this way to be happy, I'm miserable, my life is destroyed, nothing's ever going to work. Okay. And then there's so much grief and so much pain and so much anger and so much fear, and then I'm just kind of drowning in this bubble, you know, of pain. What do you do with it? Well, for a while you probably drown in it. And then you'll say, then your knowledge will gain some strength, and it'll come and bring it back. And as that knowledge gets stronger and stronger, it's easier and easier for it to pull it back, to bring it home. And as it brings it home, this is important, as it brings it home, there's so much relief, you know, because there's a freedom, there's a relaxation as you bring it home to your knowledge and to yourself, that salve is, it's not the word addictive, but addictive in the sense that we always go toward what is pleasurable. We go toward what makes us happy. And so when you learn when your mind gets into trouble and you learn the way to bring it back through your knowledge, you become more and more adept at it and more willing to do it, because the result is ananda. The reward for doing it is ananda. The reward for doing it is pain. The reward for staying in that muddle is pain, and the reward for bringing it back to yourself is ananda. And so you become more and more adept at bringing it back. You learn how to do that. It's that, that's the jnana tapas, right? Because the mind keeps running out, you keep bringing it back. Right? And as your knowledge gets stronger and stronger and stronger, the need for the mind, and with the passage of time, the need for the mind to go out becomes less and less and less. Because as the mind is peaceful, as the mind is peaceful and recognizes the source of the peace, right, it doesn't want to go out. Why would it want to go? So therefore, staying at home, it goes out. You know what I mean by that? Staying at home, it experiences the world. Staying at home, it experiences the prarabdha. Staying at home, it experiences the events that are meant to cause you dukkha. We're still in the world. Whether jnani or ajnani, it's still this bhuloka. This loka, 50-50. And so, it's not that you gain knowledge and everything becomes, you know, a happy situation. All the miserable situations continue. along with the happy ones. It's just that you don't have the same relationship to the miserable situation. The miserable situations are kept outside. That's how Swamiji will say it. You know, it took me a long time to understand what it really meant. The miserable, the people that are causing you pain, meant to cause you pain, the situations that are unhappy situations are kept outside. They aren't inside tearing you apart. It's not that they're happy situations, but your psyche has not become involved. Your psyche is still home, enjoying the ananda of yourself, and then dealing with a difficult situation. It's so different. The situation is still difficult, but you have a certain objectivity and freedom to deal with it without yourself, without your mind being out there, being ripped to shreds by it. So what he says, Krishna says here, so those free of the raga dvesha, so you can see it, he's talking, it's really, it's a beautiful verse, he's just saying, this is the mind of a jnani, free from this raga, the likes and dislikes, and the krodha, and the baya, the fear and the anger that causes, seeing everything just as myself, manmayaha, everything is just me. This is just me as Ishwara. This is just me as Brahman. Everything is just me. That's it. Right? Then he says, such a person, those people, they resort to me, not to an object. Everything. They resort to me, to Ishwara, and they resort to me as Brahman. They resort to me, not as a jiva to an object. They don't resort to an object. They resort to Ishwara. Right? It's so beautiful. Then he said, many people, it's not just now, many people have come to me. Madbhavam agata. Many people have come to me in this way, purified through the tapas of knowledge. They've come to me, because what does it really mean? They've come to me, they've recognized I am, that they are me. That's how you come to Ishwara. That's how you come to Brahman. You recognize I am Brahman. So you come to Ishwara. You recognize I am Ishwara. That's the manmayaha. They come to me through knowledge, to the tapas of knowledge. So it's just simply the removal of ignorance. They come to me recognizing that they are me. So there's nothing. There's nowhere to go. There's just something to know. Do a little of this next one, it'll take a minute. Ye yata mam prapadyante, tams tathaiva bhajamyaham, mama vartmanu vartante, manusha partha sarvashaha. Manusha parta sarvashaha. The doubt can come. Ye, yata, mam, prapadyante, tan, tata, eva, bhajami, aham. Mama, vartma, anivartante, manushaha, parta, sarvashaha. The doubt comes, can come. You know, if this is so, you know, if this is really how it is, you know, why don't you have everybody talking to Ishwara, talking to Krishna? You know, why don't you have everybody? Why don't you give this to everybody, this Atma Bhavam? Do you like some people? And you have kind of favorites that some prefer, some come to you when others don't. Why doesn't everybody just come to you? You know, what causes that is, since you're Ishwara, you're the whole, is it that you prefer some, that they would have the desire to come to you, and others wouldn't? You know? What, is there any raga dvesha and preference in you that you would bless some people, you know, to want you, and not bless the others? You know? So Krishna, just making sure that Arjuna didn't think that. He says, in whatever way a person worships me, yata, just as, right? So he says, just as a person worships me, it is in that way that I come to them. In whatever way a person worships me or comes after me, it's in that way that I come to them. And then he says, in fact, everybody, manushaha, all of the people, they are on my path alone. They are coming to me alone. Whatever they may be doing, there are many ways, many different things, but all of them are following after me. All of them are in search of me alone. But in whatever way they are seeking me, in that way I come to them. That's a very beautiful verse. I'm going to stop here because it's a big verse and I want to spend time with these two verses together. So let's stop there. There's a lot in that. In whatever way you seek me, you know, you're not seeking the whole. You're not seeking me, really, but you're seeking me as in the form of a car. In car, I said, you're not seeking me, the Lord, but you're seeking me in the form of a car, or in the form of a, you know, or in the form of a job. Or in the form of a devata who can... Anyway, we'll get into it. It's very beautiful. Let's take a minute. Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudakshate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Namaha.
Hari Om.
So it sounds like there's no exclusion whatsoever for any jiva. None. There's no preference. There's not the really neat ones and not so neat. Not.
There's only Ishwara.
Mm.
You might say, well, Ishwara is not so neat. Because there's no preference, so it's Ishwara. So you might say, well, this part of Ishwara seems neater than this part of Ishwara.
Yeah, I'm such a good guy. Those guys are
That's
terrible.
Your judgment. There's laws, you know. There's dharma, adharma, there's laws. So that's why we try to evoke Ishwara in terms of dharma. So for that antakarana shuddhi, because that's where the ananda is, the wholeness. Adharma is causes pain, you know. But it's still Ishwara. There's nothing that's not Ishwara. The loss. That's why sometimes, you know, Swamiji took the last year doing some, at Coimbatore, some really nice meditations where looking at your life and whatever is going on. In fact, I have some of those online on the Indian site. Whatever is going on, now, say for instance, you're caught in an emotion of some sort, some sorrow or something. But you accept that sorrow, but not only that, you see the network of events that went into creating that sorrow. You know, like somebody, for instance, somebody said something to you that hurt your feelings, but that was caused by this that had happened. And you'll see there's a whole network of laws that went into producing this particular result. And so you see it all as a manifestation of Ishwara, as everything is a manifestation of Ishwara. But you see how things kind of blossom in this painful way, or they blossom, come into fruition in this joyous way. You see these things, you see them coming into fruition, all of these laws in operation, just within the confines of your own karma that you're aware of your own situation that you're aware of. And then you can objectify that and you just see the workings of Ishwara. You know? Even in terms of emotion or reactions. Say you have a reaction. You see that reaction as something that is like a karma pala, that the fruit of many, many things coming together. And it's not just something that, in fact, it's not just something that you did. It's something that's been produced by a network of interacting laws, so to speak. So you would kind of take us on these little visions, vision quests.
So that doesn't cover the fullness, and even there's this huge pain.
Well, actually, what's helpful is that for that is it gives you an objectivity that releases your hold on that pain. Because part of what happens is that the ahankara, you know, the I notion gets so, your mind gets so wrapped up in the pain. But if you can get some objectivity and give it back to Ishwara, what you find is that the psyche, if your psyche, your mind starts relaxing. Because you're giving that whole network to Ishwara. You get a little distance on it. And then you become free of it. It is all mithya, you know. That's the wonderful thing. This physical body and this world, it's all come into physical manifestation, and so you can't change it on a dime. Like if you get sick, you have to work on it, and it takes days. You know, if you break your arm, it takes weeks, and all of this type of thing. But the mind is not like that, you know. The mind, it has its complexes that can take a long time to totally free yourself up. But your mind itself, say if a complex rises its head and is hurting you, you can turn it around. You know, you can talk to it in a certain way, you can be with it in a certain way, you can be released from it. Right? Because it's the mind letting go of its tension is all that's happening. Right? The mind was tight because of a complex or a reaction, it became tight. You learn how to let it go. As soon as you let it go, the problem is gone. The pain is gone. See, pain is not something corporal in terms of the emotions. So you relax. You learn how to relax the mind, but then you have to learn how to let go.
Yeah. Well, is it like...
Is it like the
pain would be like another object? It would be Ishwara in the form of an object?
Instead of object, say, yeah, but objectified. It's not like it becomes a physical object.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes objectified, and yeah, and you see it as something that's much greater. It's much greater than yourself. It's not something you're objectifying it and seeing it as part of a bigger picture that has its causes, and it's the result of something. Swamiji was using it also to get rid of kind of guilt and self-blame and all of that. Because you see that what is producing the reaction or the hurt or the anger, whatever it is, there's many things coming into that. There's many threads that have gone into making that come to fruition, not just one thing. It's not just one thought, it's just many things coming together. And so when you see that, it takes away the blame and gives the self-blame or any blame. But it allows you to kind of see it as a karmapala, in a way. You get a distance on it. And you can, you know, give it over to Ishwara.
So it's possible... Oh, yeah, actually.
Yes. Oh.
Yeah, John, you wanted to ask.
Good.
Am I remembering correctly that last week you said that if something was deep in your past, it was harder to get to that place, and if it was more current, that the acquisition of knowledge was active first on the present?
Oh, what I was talking about there was that the psyche, which, you know, we picked up our complexes in order, starting from the youngest age, right? And so they're kind of layered on each other, and some are kind of deeper down than others, covered by others, and not as, so the upper layers are not as problematic, not as threatening, and as your ego becomes stronger, I'm using ego in a positive way here, it means because your knowledge, your buddhi becomes stronger, it's able to handle, as it becomes stronger and more peaceful, the upper layers release first, you know, and then that makes the buddhi even more stronger and more peaceful because you've just unloaded some things from your unconscious. But then it's as though it sinks down a little bit deeper and more stuff is able to come up and you're also able to handle it. Right? But you couldn't have handled it before. The mind wasn't strong enough. Right? It didn't have enough knowledge, enough understanding, enough strength, ego strength. But now some more stuff will come up. And then more stuff, you know? It's kind of like... stuff coming up from the bottom of the barrel.
What do you mean by ego strength?
That's a psychological term. And when we use that term, it means that, as a psychological term, it means that the conscious mind is stable enough, secure enough, strong enough, not to become overwhelmed by a complex, a trauma from the past. Overwhelmed in a way that would be damaging to it. Right? You see what I mean? So that it is stable. So what if I, instead of say ego, what about the buddhi? Like the buddhi is strong enough and stable enough to be able to handle this next challenge. And only it's the defense system of the whole psyche as a whole protects the what in in psychological terms, it protects the ego, means the conscious mind is how they're really using it, from those traumas that would be too overwhelming for the conscious mind to be able to handle. But as the conscious mind or the buddhi becomes stronger, more secure, then these things, as it comes up, it's fine. It can handle it, kind of metabolize it. You know how to be with it, to talk with it, and in our language, you say, how to be with it. You know? And now when we're talking about it Vedantically, in light of your knowledge, what you know, these things come up. You know how to be with them, how to be kind. You understand what it is. You understand then the need of that particular complex or that particular child inside. If you want to use the child language, you know, the child inside that didn't have certain needs fulfilled and so is traumatized. And so how to sit with that, how to be with it, you know, how to be kind and to let those different complexes unwind and grow. Let the split off child parts have a chance to kind of be reparented internally by through love, through a loving attitude, understanding attitude. And there's a general, also, just on another level, a general reparenting of your mind on all levels, just through being a friend to your mind. You know, where instead of being a critic, you know, or a critic in the sense of somebody, say if you had a parent who really was disrespectful to you or not loving, didn't respect you, you know, or didn't think highly of you, didn't believe in you. I mean, that's devastating, to have a parent that doesn't think you're wonderful. Parents should think that you're absolutely wonderful. We're talking about children. When they get older, it's, oh my God. But those child years, you know, the child years.
Especially your prarabdha, your ahamkara from your prarabdha karma side is already weak. And then you get that on top of it, it can be devastating.
Yeah.
You know,
but the thing is it can be. Hopefully it's not too devastating. They say if you have just one person in your life, it could even be like one of your playmates' parents. Mm-hmm. One person that loves you, that thinks you're okay. That's how, you know, that child can still survive. You know, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you just need a little bit. But they do have to have a little bit. And of course, it's better if they have a lot. But just a little bit, and they can survive. But we can reparent all of those broken or hurt parts of ourselves, you know. But we have to be patient. And, you know. And you have to be patient with your children, too. Children require a lot of patience. But the internal parts need patience. They need to know that you're going to be there, that the adult you now, that it's recognized what's going on inside, that you're going to be there and you're not going to leave. And that you care. That you're not wishy-washy. Love you. I love you today and I hate you tomorrow. That's what is horrible. Yeah. Today you're fine, tomorrow you're not.
So how does this work with this relationship between the ahamkara, the manas, and the buddhi? So it looks like at a certain point of awareness of consciousness that what we are trying to generate here in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it's like the buddhi is starting to move into the driver's seat versus the manas sitting in the driver's seat.
I would say, yeah. But the buddhi means the buddhi that has knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise the manas kind of grabs, it usurps the buddhi and it's off and running. Yeah.
Right, so what I'm trying to understand now is the ahamkara that identifies, is always like identifying with something and seems to kind of be by default more identifying with the manas, how does this now, is it starting to identify more with the buddhi as the buddhi starts to kind of gain?
Yes,
strength?
you learn how to identify with the buddhi when we're talking on this level.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that even, this is important too. Say your mind is in pain, you're in a reaction. Are you identified with the reaction
mm-hmm.
or the buddhi who is talking to the mind? Once you're identified with the buddhi that's talking to the mind, now the mind is being held by the buddhi. Right? Because when you're in the middle of your reaction, you say, oh, I'm so miserable, I'm so unhappy, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mind, the buddhi comes in and says, oh, you're so unhappy. I know you're unhappy. Tell me about it, for instance. Now the ahankara is with the buddhi. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the buddhi is the one that has knowledge. This is just on one level. But even for a jnani, the ahankara is really always with the self, but this mithya ahankara, where's the point? If there's a buddhi here, there's an upset mind here, and then the buddhi that has knowledge. Where is the sense of self in these two? Is it here or is it here? Right? So where you want it to be is with the buddhi. And you want the buddhi to be kind, to have knowledge, to be a good jnani, a kind, a jnani with all the qualities, you know, it has self-knowledge, and has the, you know, is a good container for the atma. It has, in the sense that it has care, it has love, it has friendship, it has respect, it has compassion, that buddhi, and has knowledge. That buddhi then, is then talks to the mind.
But you know, it seems to overlap. It isn't right. Just distinctive like that.
Well, but it can be. See, because your mind is, you're very hurt and you're very, all this is going on, okay? So yes, now you're really identified with all of that.
Mm.
When you bring the buddhi in, now there's space. That act itself, do you see what I mean? It gives space because now the point of identification has shifted from the pain to the one who is holding the pain or aware of the pain or talking to the pain. And that makes just a huge, huge difference. And that's what will allow the pain, the manas, to relax. Because we can relax in the presence of love. That's the truth of it. And we're tense in the presence of rejection.
That must be why people love their dogs so much.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
So, if one is in a relationship.
Yeah.
One is in a relationship, and both at the same time, the reactions I don't know the
end of both partners?
Yeah,
are
yeah,
both
yeah.
reacting at the same
yeah.
time?
Yeah, both reacting at the same time. And then one of them can't objectify it. So we're both into the same thing now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What to do then? Because we're both need a
yeah,
parent.
Yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I'm
yeah.
saying?
Yeah, you both need a parent.
What a mess.
one really good thing to do is when a couple realizes this, that, okay, we get into this problem, we both react at the same time, so we're both drowning and neither one is there to save the other. Because neither one has any objectivity at the time. So both are drowning, you know.
Yeah.
What you have to do is when both are not drowning, right, say when you're normal, you're not in the middle of a reaction, then you come up with like a sign language. A special but something that you've worked out before. This is like it works like an auto suggestion. You're really serious about it. Works like an auto suggestion. So you both have agreed on it. That when this seems to be happening and you're both lost, one of you may remember the sign. And maybe But does it have to be a sign that you both agree to? Okay? And then say the sign is this.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever it is. But then, when the sign... I'm serious now, because this is all a suggestion.
Just looking at it, sure.
Yeah, we use this in psychology, but it's helpful.
Huh.
So you say, you both have recognized this sign, and you've already talked before. Okay, now when one of us makes the sign, what are we both going to do? So you work this out before. And then when one makes the sign, you both have to do it.
And that's not easy, actually.
Yeah.
Well, no, I was just thinking.
Well, you know, it could be we're going to take time. This is ridiculous. We're going to take time out. What we do, we're going to take time out.
You get real.
Yeah.
And we're going to come back together in a few hours, something like that.
And that pain is so overwhelming for me. I'm not interested in any science, you know.
I know.
I just want to get away.
Okay, I know. But you haven't tried this because this is an auto-suggestion, and what it means is that your mind, it triggers another part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
It triggers the buddhi.
Mm.
Oh, that's right. When we see this sign, then I'm going to do this. So it gives some room.
Mm.
Otherwise, there's nobody there. See, this, what hopefully this does is it brings in the buddhi to give room because you're both drowning. And then, it's not just, okay, we do the sign. That's not enough. You have to have decided in advance. When we do this particular sign, at that time, it's a timeout. And then you decide if you probably need to be apart for a while. You probably need to both go for a walk separately.
Yeah.
And you're both going to go and kind of try to bring your mind back, bring your knowledge back, settle down.
Can I be gone for 2 days or so, too?
No, that's too long, probably.
Okay.
Though you should both decide on that. I would say it's probably too long.
We have to come to an agreement then.
You have to come to maybe two. If you say 2 days,
yeah.
But I think initially that might be too long. And the reason is this:
huh.
You might find after you've practiced it that I really do need 2 days. But I think if you give the sign and what you've decided on was that when I give the sign, then we're going to spend 3 hours apart, 5 hours apart, the rest of the evening apart, whatever you decide. And then we're going to come back together.
And then look at.
Then you go home, or you go on a walk, or whatever, and you look at it, you bring your knowledge to the situation.
Yeah. That would work for me.
Yeah.
What was that sign all about again? That why are you giving the sign?
Well, okay, say you and your partner get in a real fight where both of your complexes are triggered and there is no way of finding each other. It's just you're just wallowing together in hell. And you can't find yourself to get out of it. You need to give, if you can give a sign, that it's like saying, we're in hell, but...
but it's not true,
and let's instigate this sign, you know? And then you instigated the sign which tells you what to do next. Once the sign is instigated that you both agreed on, that's it. Okay, we have to be apart now for a few hours, and both of you say, okay, that's what we're going to do, and you do it.
And then I could come back and say, no, I'm not ready yet to come back. I'll call you back in a...
Yeah, but you should say, if you decided 5 hours, or you decide in advance what it's going to be, and then you check back in at that time. And then the check-in might say, you know, I think I need another 5 hours. But you've worked that out in advance, too.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? So that there's a plan, because it's giving strength. It gives strength to the buddhi.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring your knowledge to it and relax and take a walk. And you know that you'll both be there, because you've made a commitment. You will both be there for each other after this period of time to talk about it and see how did we get ourselves into this. Because it's all maya. It's just a big storm. Big stormy maya. It's not real. See, you just have to get away from it because the mind's all overwhelmed.
How does Vedanta kick in there?
Just like I'm saying. I just said Maya.
It was Vedanta the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. You bring Vedanta into it.
So the Raga Dvesha, the Maya and Krodha, that's manas.
It is, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The raga, the buddhi gets pulled into it, right? Mm-hmm. You know? So the buddhi will be overwhelmed by the desire.
Okay.
And get caught in it.
But the emotional mind is part of manas, right?
Yeah. It is. But that will overwhelm the buddhi.
So what's the rational versus emotional part of the mind? What's their relationship as part of both being part of manas? How do they kind of
work that out? We separate the buddhi and the manas. It's not like they're totally different.
Mm-hmm.
But the buddhi is stronger than the manas, actually. The buddhi is the one that can quiet the manas. It can also be overwhelmed by the manas and taken for a big ride.
Mm-hmm.
But the buddhi is also the one that can... It's like the buddhi is like the charioteer, right? It's the one who's driving with the reins. Then the manas is the reins and the horses are the sense organs. I think that's how they do it in the Katha Upanishad. Right?
There's a healthy manas. There's also kind of...
The whole thing can be very healthy.
Yeah.
It's not healthy when it's taking you for a ride.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But there's nothing wrong with
emotions and feelings and all of that.
So can you say that the manas without the buddhi on board is kind of undifferentiated?
Well, what if you said the manas without an educated buddhi?
Right? It's kind of undifferentiated.
Well, it's just following the sense organs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. It doesn't have a mind. It's like the manas is without the buddhi. Right? Lost. This is being... Whatever the feelings are, it's like the id for Freudians. It's kind of like all of the feelings, all of the emotions, you know, that are being revved up by the...
Dramatic.
It's a lot of self-preservation in a limited sense of self.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we're getting a little bit too... Well, what we're doing is we're relating the terms... I started it, but we're starting to relate the terms a little bit too much to psychology. Because manas and buddhi are their own terms.
It's sort of like the concept of the mithya ahankara, in a way. And it's kind of interesting to think about like that.
It is like that, right?
What do you mean?
First of all, the ahankaras is, on one level, the ahankaras is a mithya as everything else. But for say for jnani, you know, you are yourself,
mm-hmm.
right? But then the ahankara, there is an identification with the buddhi. If I'm thinking or I'm working on something, there is an identification with my emotions, an identification with my body. That's all taking place.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mithya to me. It's mithya anyway, but it's mithya to me.
Okay.
Yeah, so it doesn't have a hold on me like that. I see it as mithya.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And it stays there. It
doesn't vanish. What is it, mithya? There's only one thing that isn't mithya, and that's my own svarupa. Yeah. And that svarupa doesn't need an ahankara. It is the very self of the ahankara. Right? It's like sometimes I'll say, this is a lamp. I can say, I don't need to say lamp for it to be a lamp. The lamp labels it. Or in reality, the ahankara is labeling the atma. The atma doesn't require an ahankara. It doesn't require to be labeled. I am without the I am. Right? And so I don't need an ahankara. I don't need an I thought. I don't need anything. I am me without the thought. Right? And so now the ahankara, I can say, well, the ahankara for the jnani is bodhita. It's sublated. It is its mithya. Right? Or I can say I can talk in a different way. I can say for the jnani, the ahankara resolves in the atma. It lands in the atma. But nevertheless, that ahankara, my sense of self does not require my mind, or an ahankara, or the universe. my being, the meanness, the me, you don't need an ahamkara for you to be you. You are you. Without the, your self-experience doesn't require the ahamkara. Doesn't require the universe. It's itself. Right? So the ahamkara for the jnani is always mithya anyway. But then, when I was talking before, I was talking about it when it's identified with the buddhi, because it's thinking or talking or whatever, it's identified with the emotion, feelings identified with the body. But all of that is mithya. And it can be, all of that can be happening, but nothing's happening to my sense of self.
But the mind says I'll lose my sense of self unless I'm labeling it. I mean,
only when the mind does says that, that's because there's some doubt there and lack of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
But when that knowledge is clear, that isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that avidya is not there. That ignorance isn't there. So your self-experience is your self-experience all the time, no matter what. The creation is not interfering with it. What that means is that the mithya, ahamkara, is never interfering, and it doesn't need not even be there. None of it interferes with yourself. Right?
You know, this question, now where's fear and where's doubt and where's these phenomena? You know, it seems like instead of saying they're in the mind, in the manas, it seems to me makes more and more sense as I just listen to what you say. It just kind of comes more out of an undeveloped buddhi, really, that is somehow in a confused relationship with the manas. Because the manas is really just taking in sense perceptions, right, and processing
that. No, but we give
that
more to the manas than that. Yeah. We give the emotions, especially dukkha, and those type of emotions to the manas.
So it's interesting. I'm just still not quite getting where this whole terrain of inquiry moves, you know, the phenomena of our human experiences shift from the manas into the buddhi, or if this is just a conceptual kind of thing that we're playing with to just somehow capture the deeper sense of the inquiry, you know.
I think in a way it is conceptual, because when we look at how they explain it as four different types of cognition. Say you have the antakarna. The antakarna itself means inner antakarna instrument. That's the name, antakarna. The antakarna has four types of cognition. Right? The ahamkara. Right? The buddhi, which is the definitive thinking. The jnanavritti, where you say, this is what it is. This is what I know. It's your knowledge, really, is the buddhi. Knowledge even in Vyavahara. Just what you know, that's buddhi. The manas is the fluctuating mind. It doesn't have to do with, there's no knowledge there. There's cognition, there's feelings, there's wondering, there's doubting. There's no clarity, right? And so it's in that sphere where there's feelings and emotions and all of these things. But it's not like we have the ahamkara up here, the buddhi is here, the manas is here. They're all part of one antakarna, and the other one is citta, the memories. So it's just really, maybe you should look at it as trying to just distinguish how the different ways the antakarna is working.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't they sometimes just labeled as types of thoughts?
Types of cognitions, yes. Yeah. Four types of cognitions.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what I mean. If you kind of, instead of looking at them as different functions,
yeah,
more. But we will say, we do say, though, that the buddhi is superior and inner to the manas because it's stronger and more pervasive.
And the citta doesn't get...
Citta is memory.
Well, it is perceived as memory regarding, this life or past life.
Oh, I think all memory, I think they'll even put all the sensitive to everything will go into that memory. You know, but on levels that when we're really talking about it on citta, they're not in the unconscious, but what we have available to us. Because we're looking really at four types of cognition. And so your buddhi is able to recall. So what is it that it recalls? A past occurrence. And so what is that called? Chitta.
And not
so we have a place, we're able to recall. And so then you say, then you ask, well, where do you think the sanchitta goes in the jiva? The sanchitta are, you know, all of the past karmas mm-hmm. that have infinite number. Mm-hmm. So they can put that in the chitta, but it's not very clear. Mm-hmm. It's not a very clear delineation.
So smriti?
Smriti means memory.
And chitta is the same?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Though we usually use the word chitta, but yes, smriti is memory.
Well, the chief fear is the fear of, seems to be in general, it's the fear that I will not exist, I will die.
Probably fear of death is the chief fear, yeah.
Yeah, and that's when I was talking about self-preservation, it seems like the manas is very tied to that somehow. It's like, whereas the buddhi has some more clarity.
Well, maybe I would say maybe because fear is an emotion, right? It's not just cheer. You don't say, oh, I mean, it's not an intellection. It's an emotion. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, maybe. Yeah. But what is going to generate it is your understanding or your ignorance. What generates the fear, you know? What mm-hmm. generates the emotion is the way you relate to your situation, to who you are. Are we done?